From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. In much-anticipated testimony, FBI Director James Comey this morning told members of the House Intelligence Committee that the FBI is investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election. He also confirmed the scope of the investigation.
And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts.
Comey also said there is no evidence to back up President Trump's claim that he was wiretapped by President Obama before the election.
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets.
Well, this morning, before the hearing began, the president tweeted, quote, "The real story that Congress, the FBI, and all others should be looking into is the leaking of classified information. Must find leaker now." Well, joining us with more is NPR's diplomatic correspondent, Michelle Kellerman. Hi there, Michelle.
Yeah, hi, Meghna.
So first of all, put this in perspective for us. How significant is it that Comey has confirmed the existence of an investigation?
It was quite extraordinary and unexpected, really. The FBI usually doesn't comment on continuing investigations. He wasn't making any promises about how long this is going to take, and he wasn't responding to questions about specific people that they might be investigating in this. But he did confirm that the investigation began last July and that they're looking into whether there was any coordination. That was the word he used, not collusion, but coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians.
And so do we have any guess, any understanding as to where the investigation might go from here, or but what might be the consequence of Director Comey's testimony today?
Well, you know, the Democrats were trying to press him on very specific people, bringing up names of people that we know that were working on the Trump campaign who have connections to Russia, Paul Manafort, Carter Page. Also, a lot of questions about Roger Stone, who's a Republican operative and a confidant of Trump, who once admitted that he had this back channel to WikiLeaks. But, you know, Comey was very clear that he wasn't going to be talking specifically about any of those people.
Now, in reference to that tweet from President Trump, which I read a little earlier, the one he tweeted out this morning when he said the real story is that Congress and the FBI and all of us should be looking into is the leaking of classified information. Several Republican representatives during the hearings today really took up that charge and focused on the collection of information and the leaking of it. So here's Florida Republican Tom Rooney.
In your opinion, would leaking of a U.S. person who has been unmasked and disseminated by intelligence community officials, would that leaking to the press hurt or help our ability to conduct national security
hurt.
Matters?
And the last word there you heard was from the head of the NSA, Admiral Mike Rogers. So talk about this. Lots of questions about leaking.
A lot. And it led to Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, having to explain this idea of incidental collection. That is when they have surveillance on foreigners that, you know, Americans, U.S. persons, U.S. companies might be mentioned in these things. And usually that information is masked. The names are removed. And Director Comey of the FBI also said the culture in the FBI and the NSA is to be obsessive about that, protecting Americans who might be caught up in this incidental collection, as they say. But there have been a lot of reports that before leaving, the Obama administration wanted some more of this information known and may have lowered the classification of some information or disseminated it more broadly within the government. And that's what Republicans were hammering home in this hearing today.
And Michelle, both James Comey and Mike Rogers both said that there's no evidence of any wiretapping by the Obama administration at Trump Tower. Any significance to that other than just the confirmation that they have no evidence?
Well, you know, this is something that President Trump has tweeted. Trump had also suggested that the Obama administration got the Brits to spy on Trump Tower. Comey and Rogers say there's no evidence of that. And that kind, those kind of comments can really anger allies. I mean, we did see the UK come out strongly against that. And the British government is really a key ally on intelligence matters. So those kinds of tweets do have implications.
That's Michelle Kellerman. She's NPR's diplomatic correspondent. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Hearings are also underway on the Hill for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Colorado Judge Neil Gorsuch. Let's get a reminder of just who this man is lawmakers are considering. From Dahlia Lithwick, she covers the Supreme Court for Slate. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Robin.
And Donald Trump, of course, said Gorsuch would be a judge in the mold of Antonin Scalia, the conservative he would replace if confirmed. Gorsuch certainly seems more genial, you know, than Scalia. But tell us more about what that comparison means.
I think I would say he's like the young Scalia, not kind of the old cranky pants Scalia from the last couple of years who was throwing elbows, but very, very much a principled conservative in the manner of Scalia. He is down the line an originalist, a strict constructionalist. I think in some ways, you know, in some nuances, maybe more conservative than Scalia. I think he shares some of Scalia's sort of surprising departure from the court's right wing on criminal defendants and some criminal law issues. But I think it's very fair to say that he is somebody who, when it comes to his statutory interpretation, his constitutional worldview, he is an old school originalist.
Well, then why would Dianne Feinstein, the Democrat, say Gorsuch is a puzzle? You know, tell us more about what his record might tell us.
Well, I think he's a puzzle because in many, many ways, he hasn't spoken or written, even in his 10-year career on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, Robin. He hasn't spoken out or had really a huge imprint on a lot of issues that really matter to the committee. And so, for instance, we don't have a direct case from him on abortion, even though Donald Trump has promised that he would put up someone who will reverse Roe v. Wade. Same, I think, can be said of the big question everybody's wondering, what's he going to do with executive power? What is he thinking about Donald Trump's travel ban? We don't have very good clues about that. So I think the puzzle isn't that he's all that internally inconsistent. It's just that the nature of where he sits on the 10th Circuit means that he has not brushed up against a lot of cases and doctrine that we really would need to know about.
Yeah, Feinstein said she wants to know where he stands on voting rights, the right to choose, as you mentioned, guns, the ability of federal agencies to regulate, especially in the Trump administration. We know that he worked for George W. Bush's Justice Department. He supported programs like warrantless wiretapping and the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo. But there's a new question made public last night in a letter that one of Gorsuch's former law students, Jennifer Sisk, sent to Senators Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Grassley on the Judiciary Committee. In it, she said Gorsuch, who was then her law professor last year, told students, including her, that employers like law firms should ask women in the interview stage about their plans for having children because he went on to indicate women manipulate employers to get maternity benefits. She said at one point he asked students to raise their hands. You know, you've seen this, haven't you? And when not a lot of students raised their hands, he said, oh, come on, all your hands should be up. This is what women do. They manipulate employers to get maternity benefits. That seems like a new wrinkle.
It is a new wrinkle, and I think, as you point out, it's kind of a bombshell that has just dropped, so we haven't heard his side of this. I think that what we are hearing, at least from the law school where he was teaching and other defenders, is, look, you know, professors say controversial things in class every day. It's their job to push buttons. The student's response is, hey, this was the second to last class of the year. He had not been teaching using this button-pushy style up until this point. It really seemed as though he was trying to make a point about women gaming big law firms in order to, you know, time their pregnancies, take the money and run. Mm-hmm. So she really heard it as something quite inflammatory. And I guess I should say it's also obviously illegal under federal law to ask women as they enter law firms, are you gaming this in order to use your pregnancy? So I think it raises questions not necessarily about this factual dispute, but I think that he has this long history history, particularly in the Hobby Lobby case, the Little Sisters case, cases dealing with women's reproductive freedom, where he has heavily erred on the side of the religious employers who will not feel comfortable giving women contraception under the Affordable Care Act. There is a sense that he is not on Team Woman, and I think this is probably another thing you can put on that pile that makes women very nervous.
Any chance, Dahlia Lithwick, any scenario in which he doesn't get confirmed?
You know, this is what people are doing, right? They're counting noses for, do the Democrats need to filibuster? And if they filibuster, do the Republicans, you know, blow up the filibuster? So I think this is very much a three-dimensional chess game that has to do with, really, is this the hill that Senate Democrats want to die on? And I think there are many other issues that feel more urgent. I will say that undergirding this hearing is such a sense of grievance from Senate Democrats. This should have been Merrick Garland's hearing. And I think that Democrats who are not in power but very, very angry in the Senate are going to really have to calibrate how much that plays a part in today's proceedings.
Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate. And for us today, Dahlia, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Spring began this morning, so let's get those kids outside. And when they come back in, you might be tempted to give them a spritz of hand sanitizer. Well, don't. That's according to the authors of the book Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. B. Brett Finley, a professor of microbiology at the University of British Columbia, and Marie-Claire Arrieta, an assistant professor of physiology and pharmacology at the University of Calgary, argued that the overuse of sanitizers is hurting our microbiome. That's the collection of good microbes that live in and on our bodies. And that could compromise our children's health. We spoke with both of them last September, and I started by asking Professor Finley to explain the book's title.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're not suggesting you shovel buckets of dirt down a poor newborn's mouth. But the concept is there, and I think we all sort of deep down know this. And this is really a hangover we've had over the last century of cleaning up our world. You know, in the early 1900s, 30% of the kids in U.S. cities died before the age of one. Now less than 0.1% die of infections. You have sewer systems, you get rid of the mice and the rats, you collect the garbage, you bring in clean water, clean food, you're bringing antibiotics. We have had a major success story, and kids don't die of infections anymore. So that's terrific. But in the last, under a decade or so, we're now starting to realize that, well, not only are we killing all the bad microbes, we're killing the ones that actually we are starting to realize are good for us. And so this really hypervigilance to sanitation has wiped out a whole microbial generation, really. And so our kids are no longer exposed to the kids that humans have developed with. So they're just not getting the bugs that Homo sapiens evolved with. And now this has real impact on what we call Western society diseases like asthma, allergies, obesity, diabetes. These all have microbial links.
Right. So I'm really glad you said that because, of course, as you mentioned, a century ago, there were important public health reasons for wanting to reduce infections. But sort of having gone too far or having been too good at controlling pathogens is a really interesting idea. So can you tell us a little bit more about the microbial links to, I mean, let's take asthma, first of all. What are the good bacteria, good microbes that we're missing that might contribute to higher prevalence of asthma?
We recently last year showed that when babies, really, really small babies, three-month-old babies, are missing just four types of bacteria, that puts them at a very high risk of developing asthma later in life.
So and what is it that the bacteria, those four types, are doing that protect children from asthma later in life?
One of the main tasks that bacteria do for us is mature our immune system. We're born without microbes, but as soon as we're born, we get millions of them. And our immune system relies on them to complete the maturation process. And if they skip or get depleted of some microbes, the immune system becomes sloppy. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do, which is to try and distinguish friend from foe. And later, it leads to these type of diseases like asthma.
Asthma and allergies and perhaps even contributes to obesity?
Yeah, for sure. So immune diseases like inflammatory bowel disease, but also metabolic diseases like diabetes and obesity. Another thing that microbes do is that they're key decision makers on how we store or burn fat. Mm. So it's not surprising that these are the diseases that are growing so much in society.
Right. Let's just take an ideal scenario, a healthy, you know, young child having these additional microbes in their body. I mean, in the book, you write about how they're so important. They're like almost an additional organ in the human body. Can you tell us more about that?
So early in life, that's when your body's doing most of its developing, right? And so we now realize that, as Clara said, these microbes educate the immune system. And without these microbes, the immune system actually doesn't develop normally. And even such things as the brain, we now know that there's, you know, the gut-brain connection. We realize these microbes make molecules can affect how the brain develops, even in utero and early at birth. And there's these crazy experiments in animals that you can actually take, say, a depressed mouse, do a fecal transfer, only move the feces into a normal mouse, that mouse will become depressed just by moving the microbes.
Does some of the research indicate that the gut microbes might actually be secreting particular chemicals that are very important for mood regulation?
Yeah, they can make neurotransmitters. They can also interface with the immune system, which actually affects the neurons. And they can affect how it's called the vagus nerve that hooks the gut to the brain, how it all works. So they're really... We used to always think the brain is just talking to the gut. We now realize the gut's also talking to the brain, and that has been a real mind shift in the whole field of neurobiology.
So before we move on, I want to ask you, so if a parent or just anyone listening to this, you know, they're hearing about the gut microbiome and they're thinking, well, okay, should I be eating more yogurt? Should I go out and buy those probiotics? I mean, I feel like there's a big industry rising around, you know, around this new science. But in terms of like taking probiotics, I don't think it's necessarily been proven that that makes a positive difference. Has it?
Yeah, it hasn't. If you show up to a drugstore or to a health store by yourself and try to pick a product, it's extremely hard. One of the things that we did with the book is try to suggest to use only the products that have been shown to be beneficial. We created a link to a really, really neat chart that summarizes the products that have been tested.
So are you suggesting in the book that essentially like we are keeping the environment surrounding kids today just too clean and that they're not interacting with good microbes or even bad ones that give their immune system a good workout?
Well, there's no data to say that having diseases, infectious disease, actually improves you. So we don't have to infect our kids. But what we are sort of pointing forward is you need a balance between the risk of exposing your kid to an infection versus the risk of exposing them just to the good microbes. For example, a kid is playing the sandbox. Well, that's good, but if there's cat feces in the cat, maybe you should avoid that. You know, the kid's licking the floor in your house, that's probably okay. They're not allowed to lick the floor in the subway station. But the other thing to remember is the chance of your kids contracting polio on the playground in, you know, modern America. It's not like it was 100 years ago. So, you know, you don't have to wash your child's hands 100 times a day when they're playground. Just wash them once when you come in, you know, for dinner with soap and water, not antibacterials.
There's some pretty deeply ingrained habits that might be a little difficult to unwind. Because I was just thinking, you know, in one of my kids' school, when I drop my kid off in the mornings, I see a lot of her fellow students have like little clip-on hand sanitizers on their
everywhere.
Backpack.
They are. Yeah, for sure. These things are marketed with the illusion that they're going to make us healthy, and they're not. I mean, in the hospital, yes, you would need them. If you're out camping and you don't have a good source of water to wash yourself, yeah, you could use them, but we do not need them.
So did the FDA then take a good step when it recently banned
very
several antibacterial chemicals that are frequently found in antibacterial soaps?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, that's because the study showed they didn't work.
I mean,
they didn't do any different than soap and water. So in terms of what you wash with, soap and water, you know, for meals, perhaps after the bathroom kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you don't need to be the hyper clean.
Right. You know, we've been talking a lot about sort of ways that we've been trying to sanitize our environment. But in the book, you also underscore that there's a very, very important thing that parents can do with their children to encourage the growth of this good microbiome. And that has to do with the food that children eat.
That's right. Microbes, they thrive pretty much on fiber. That's what they're there for. They're there to help us digest plant-derived fibers that we as mammals cannot digest. So our current diet packed with refined flours and sugars, this is not the right food for a healthy, diverse microbiome. So think about vegetables and fruits and whole grains instead of refined ones.
The other thing to remember is that white sugar, white flour type things, they're absorbed very early in the intestine, in the upper intestine. They don't reach the large intestine where all the microbes are. So in essence, even though you're eating white sugar and white fat, you're actually starving your microbes because they didn't even get there. So that's why you're encouraged to eat the harder to digest foods like fibers, like fruits, like vegetables, because that's actually feeding the microbes. Final point I want to make, which I find very scary, is that each generation we get cleaner and cleaner. Mm. Each generation we have less and less microbes. Does that mean that our great-great-parents' microbes are actually an endangered species and we can't have them anymore even if they want them? So there's a lot of concern that each generation, as we clean these up, like any other endangered species, they will go extinct and we can't go back to the way we were, which is really scary, I think.
Hmm. There's a frequent choice that parents have to make when they take their kids to the doctor, for example. You know, should you ask for the antibiotic when your kid has a fever or not?
What we're now realizing is, like many things, we've overused antibiotics. And they're antibiotics, yes, they will kill the infection-causing agents, but they kill all microbes equally well. So they will kill the good ones and the bad ones together. So there is a sort of a concerted effort to use antibiotics only when you need them. Now, if a kid has a serious bacterial infection and antibiotics will work, use them by all means. They will save that kid's life. But don't use them if they might not work. And I would just thought, what the heck, you know, it's a cold, it can't hurt kind of thing. We now realize it does hurt. And so we have to be much wiser in our use of antibiotics.
Mm. Well, finally, for parents listening right now who are really thinking, maybe I need to make some changes in how I live, what would you recommend on a daily basis? What adjustments should people be making in order to encourage a healthy microbiome?
Toss that gel hand sanitizer. It doesn't really work. Diet is huge, and if they can, to get a dog. And of course, only if they can, because you should be a responsible dog owner and not just get it to promote health. But dogs are a great vector, if you may, or vehicle of microbes. They go outside and they bring that outdoors into your home in the form of dirty paws and all of that. And that's good. In fact, that decreases the chances of children of developing allergies and asthma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I had to, of course, use antibiotics wisely. And then I'll finally sort of let a kid be a kid. I mean, what do kids do? Watch a kid in action. They put everything they possibly can in their mouth. Why are they doing that? Well, they're trying to figure out, oh, this is the world I live in. You know, you put a stick in your mouth, the kid probably won't get sick and say, oh, this tastes terrible and they won't do it again kind of thing. So I think this whole hyper, don't touch the world we live in has to change.
Well, B. Brett Finley is a professor of microbiology at the University of British Columbia. Marie-Claire Arrieta is an assistant professor in the Department of Physiology and Pharmacology at the University of Calgary. And their new book is Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
So let's take a minute to discuss brackets, which have been crashing. We're talking March Madness, specifically today, the NCAA men's basketball tournament, which will head into the regional round this weekend without last year's defending champs, Villanova, and another high seed, Duke. And those are delirious South Carolina fans celebrating their win over the Duke Blue Devils on Sunday, South Carolina's first NCAA win in 44 years. Villanova, by the way, fell to Wisconsin. Sports commentator John Bacon on the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And John, we'll talk about your Michigan Wolverines in a minute. But start with both Villanova and Duke losing.
Yeah, quite shocking, to say the least. Villanova, as you pointed out, the returning national champions. You got to say, South Carolina got a boost from something called the bathroom bill, which I know you've discussed in your show before.
Yeah.
The LGBT, anti-LGBT, it's seen as, bill in North Carolina, which prompted the NCAA to move all tournaments from North Carolina, in this case to South Carolina, which is where, of course, the Gamecocks are from, so Duke lost their home state advantage. So that could be changing sometime soon. So
yeah.
Duke going down intensely, of course, is quite shocking. The ACC itself, the Atlantic Coast Conference, in which Duke plays, had 9 teams in the tournament. Only one is left, North Carolina.
Well, Louisville fell to Michigan, your team there, but just who's left?
who's left amongst the big boys? You'd say Gonzaga and North Carolina, of course, both one seeds, two seeds, Kentucky and Arizona. Those are probably the favorites going forward.
Boy, North Carolina, that was a little squeaker there. Anyway, Michigan, great story. Their plane skids off the runway on their way to the Big Ten tournament. They had a vote to decide whether or not to even go to the tournament on a later flight. Now they're in the Sweet 16.
All shocking, I guess you'd say. John Beilein is the coach. He's beloved by the players, and now you see why. The plane was facing 60-mile-per-hour winds, so the pilot going down the runway slammed on the brakes. It crashed through a fence. It went through a ditch, which snapped off the landing gears. It's pretty serious business here. And, of course, the uniforms were trapped underneath the plane. So they had to play their first game in the Big Ten tournament last week in their practice uniforms. They won four games in 4 days after, as you said. The coach said, we can play tomorrow, or we can forfeit. It's up to you guys entirely. I'm with you either way. There are bigger things than a basketball game.
Yeah.
And, of course, the players chose to play, and they have since they've won seven in a row. So that team is on a roll.
We should mention we're going to take up the women at another time. They're in their second round. Teams like Syracuse, Kansas State, Stanford, Oregon. Oh, UConn is in there as well.
Don't forget UConn. Yeah, right. Don't forget Notre Dame either.
Right. So. We'll take the end. By the way, South Carolina. But we'll take that up at another time. But on the men's side, who do you think takes it all?
Well, this time of year, Robin, I like to refer to William Goldman, the screenwriter who said famously, nobody knows anything. The first weekend already proved it. Your bracket's probably already busted.
Right.
Look, the favorites are probably North Carolina, but there's South Carolina and there's Michigan, of course. If you want a flyer, go with those teams right there.
Right. And just a player that you're watching that maybe isn't going to go all the way to the end, but people should pay attention to.
I got to go homer on this one. Sorry, folks. Sorry, Alex Ashlock, my good Illinois buddy. Derek Walton Jr. put the team on his back 2 months ago at the players-only meeting saying, we stink. We're 1-3 in the Big Ten. We got a player go home. Since then, they've been on fire, and it's all Derek Walton.
Yeah, you know, there's always that one. Sports commentator John Bacon in Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, thanks as always.
Robin, thank you.
Students are still anxiously awaiting word if they've been accepted to their top choice colleges and universities. We're all pulling for you because you've done everything you can, right? Grades, tests, maybe some essays, and I'm sure you've scrubbed your social media accounts of any potentially embarrassing posts, right? Well, did you also consider using your social media profiles to your advantage? Say, to show schools that you'd be a great fit. Turns out more admissions officers are looking to social media to gain a deeper, positive understanding of college applicants. Alan Katzman is the founder of Social Assurity. He works with students to curate their social media content. Welcome.
Hello.
So first of all, tell me, basically, people think it's common sense that what you put on social media really matters because college admissions officers look at that stuff. But does that common sense bear out? Is it important in the admissions process?
It's becoming increasingly important. Recently, there's been a survey out that has anywhere from 35 to 50% of college admissions officers taking a look. But the critical element here is that they're not looking to find embarrassing photos or embarrassing posts. They're looking to find information about that applicant. That's where I think education needs to come in. Because it's not only increasingly important in college admissions, but scholarship reviews and then employment as well.
I completely agree. And employment's an entirely another world, but an mm-hmm. important one as well. But I just want to focus for a second here on college admissions, right? Because I'm seeing, I think this is the survey from Kaplan, right, that finds that of those admissions officers who said they did look at social media profiles of applicants, that 47% said that it actually had a positive impact on the application, but 42% said it had a negative impact. So it still can potentially damage an applicant's prospects, can't it?
It absolutely can. The problem, the reason why we started Social Assurity a few years ago was that we were seeing this increase in importance of social media as part of the college admissions review process. And all the advice out there was basically, don't let anything you post cost you admission to your dream school. And what students started to do was find platforms far off the, we call them digital interstates, where mm-hmm. they can't be found. Going under aliases, that missed the point. We've spoken to a number of colleges and college admissions officers who are saying, we're looking at social media to learn more about the candidate.
Right.
So we have to teach students that they need to take the spin to a productive use of social media.
I have so many reactions to this. One, and then they range from one, just me shaking my head in a little bit of sadness that young people have to constantly think about their own branding. But on the other hand, it makes perfect sense to me because, you know, we call one of the common monikers for young people is they're digital natives. So, of course, we should be looking at, you know, what they put out there in the digital world to get a better understanding of who they are as a whole person. For example, I'm seeing an example here of an applicant to a college who took to Twitter once to describe facilitating a panel on LGBTQ rights, but it's actually not something that the applicant had even mentioned on her college application. And it enhanced her application overall because the admissions officer bothered to look.
That is a perfect example of what we advocate when we work with students and their families. You can expand the reach of your application by including links to social media profiles. So if you are a photographer, an artist, you can create a portfolio on Instagram and put that link on your application. We work with students to build digital portfolios on LinkedIn. You know, it's very hard to present yourself fully on a common application with a 500-word essay and very limited space to present your character and your credentials and your true interests. And the competitive nature of college admissions today, that ability to stand out and show commitment or deep interest in an activity or service goes very far to define your character and good citizenship.
So let me just ask for a little more detail here in terms of what admissions officers are looking for when they do these searches. I mean, creating a portfolio of your work through social media is one thing. But, you know, how would they get a sense of, as you were saying, things like citizenship, things like commitment to projects, things like grit? I mean, how do you communicate those things?
We're very big on blogging. We encourage students of all ages to start writing about things that interest them. We had this one client whose passion was playing the viola for an orchestra, both in the community and the school. And we worked with him and got him thinking about, you know, I play this, I rehearse, and I practice this instrument 15 to 20 hours a week, yet I'm still keeping up really good grades. Well, that's a very effective time management. They've been playing it since they were 8 years old. That's commitment. Chances are they're going to carry that activity into college with them. And they built a LinkedIn profile pretty much highlighting the attributes and skills related to orchestra and playing the instrument. And we do know, because LinkedIn tells you when somebody looks at your profile, that someone at Harvard College looked at that profile. And, you know, that student today is finishing up his first year at Harvard. Hmm. So it didn't hurt him.
So I have a couple more questions for you. One is just a reality check here. We're not saying at all that social media profiles could overwhelm the importance of grades, test scores, recommendations, the standard things that everyone has to put in a college admissions packet.
We are and we aren't. Grades and strength of schedule is the most critical element, right, for college decisions. The importance of standardized test scores has been questioned. And the other thing that we're seeing, and this is where the education comes in for students, they're kind of casually communicating with college admissions offices, using college names in their communications. You know, social media is fully monitored by colleges, by organizations. Everybody monitors their mentions. And it can either work positively. If your profiles are in good shape, they can learn more about you. They can see that you're interested in going to that school. Or as you said earlier, it can work against you.
Yeah. So a couple more things here, because earlier you said that, you know, managing a social media presence isn't just important for college, but it's obviously scholarships and jobs, you said later on. What about when young people feel, you know, they're politically active, which so many young people are today? Like what if there's a politically minded high schooler who's part of their high school Republican group, or someone who's active in Black Lives Matter? I mean, this is also a fundamental part of their identity. How do they manage that aspect on social media in the politically fraught world that we live in?
We advocate an authentic representation of yourself online. And we also remind students that there is no longer a distinction between what's professional and what's personal. If you decide to post it, it's part of who you are. And if you're worried about alienating people who disagree with your viewpoint, I challenged them. I said, are you really going to be happy working in an environment that doesn't share your political views? But I think it's a personal decision about how much of yourself you want to put out there. Because everything you post, and we stress to students all the time, nothing disappears. You're never anonymous. And anyone in the world with an interest in finding what you've posted can find it.
Right. Finally, Alan Katzman, I'm constantly sensitive to how the pernicious inequities present themselves in our society. And it occurred to me, I mean, you're running a business advising young people on how to manage their social media presence, which is terrific for the kids who, you know, have the means to hire someone like you. I'm concerned that that might put them at an advantage over the millions of young people who maybe couldn't afford it. So for those young people who aren't lucky enough to be able to hire someone like Alan Katzman, what are one or two pieces of advice you'd give them to make their social media presence as bright and reflective of who they are as possible?
Well, two things. All of our work is been produced in online courses, and we do a lot of work with economically disadvantaged students because we think the stories that a lot of these students can tell are much more compelling than their more affluent counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as responsibilities, maybe taking care of siblings while their parents are working, name it, right? And we think that social media is a great equalizer, that as long as we can get the message out that there is an audience beyond your friends and get them to think about content that, again, showcases their responsibilities, their maturity, their judgment, these are all very strong factors when people start making decisions about you.
Well, we'll see if we can get links to some of those resources at our website, hereandnow.org. Alan Katzman, social media expert and founder of Social Assurity. Very eye-opening and a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's the first day of spring, and a tally shows that this winter has seen above-average temperatures in parts of the country. For the first time in decades, the length of the U.S. ski season is shrinking. And as climate change changes up winter, one industry expert says most ski mountains in southern New England could be out of business in 25 years unless they diversify their offerings. But as Fred Bever of Maine Public reports, ski areas in northern New England could benefit.
New England's weather's been pretty up and down this winter, including here at Sugarloaf in western Maine. But skier Ken Erickson says it could be worse. Some mountains in the region's southern tier have seen very poor conditions, and ski refugees are trekking north.
This year they struggled. Lower New Hampshire. Well, you know how we know that? When it gets like that, they all come up here, and you see them on the lift.
Erickson, whose permanent home is Gloucester, Massachusetts, has been skiing here since the 70s. He says weather volatility is always an issue in the sport, but the threat of climate change frightens him.
I have big concerns about it, and I can see the season getting very short.
And the U.S. ski season is shortening up after a prolonged period when advances in snowmaking were helping to extend it. Daniel Scott directs the University of Waterloo's Interdisciplinary Center on Climate Change in Ontario, Canada. He says a continuing warming trend, as well as more extreme temperature swings, seem to have put the brakes on that snowmaking expansion.
We may have reached a sort of peak season era in the 2000s when we had, as you know, a lot of snowmaking penetration, and it's still growing in different markets. But now the climate has shifted just that much that in these last 5 years anyway, the average season length has tipped down for the first time in over 30 years.
Scott has a sobering analysis for the Northeast. Even under the most optimistic climate change models, all ski areas in southern New England will no longer be economically viable by 2040. That is, not if their revenue stream depends on reliable snowfall, particularly during the crucial Christmas to New Year's holiday week. Lower altitude resorts in southern New England are most vulnerable.
Sorry, and adding snowmaking capacity isn't necessarily the answer. We've seen that in the last couple of years. where it's just too warm to even make it, or you do make it, but it melts so quickly, so you're throwing money out the door. So yeah, they'll have to look at how to diversify their revenues, and not every ski area is able to do that.
But one door closes, another opens, right? Particularly for the altitude-advantaged survivors in northern New England. Most ski areas in Vermont, New Hampshire, and across northern Maine. That's why one-time New England ski magnate Les Otten is building global warming into his $1.5 billion proposal to revive a defunct resort high up in New Hampshire's White Mountains called the Balsams. It was never a ski resort, but an historic summertime destination that Otten says is well set up to be resilient against climate change, with a golf course and nearby lakes and rivers to bring in visitors outside of the ski season.
What we have to do is we have to create a winter that's sort of equal to the summer, and that's the Balsams opportunity.
The site is in a snowy sweet spot that could enjoy reliable skiing days through mid-century at least. Otten says he doesn't wish ill to others in the business, but he acknowledges that shorter and even terminal seasons at more southerly resorts could send skiers and investors his way.
It's a hard industry to succeed in, and no one ever tried to take advantage or live off the disappointment of another. But it is very clear to me, looking outside the ski industry, that global warming is very real. The effects are real, and I think you have to plan for it.
Major ski conglomerates are responding, buying up geographically diverse mountains to hedge against local weather volatility, while offering winter and summer passes that now give visitors a cross-continental choice of mountains and seasons. Just last month, Colorado-based Vail Resorts announced a big move, purchasing Vermont's Stowe Mountain. And diversification is now the name of the game, thus the proliferation of mountain zip lines, canopy tours, gravity coasters, and golf courses. At Sugarloaf, its host town of Carrabassett Valley and a nearby nonprofit called Maine Huts and Trails are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to add summer to the traditional wintertime destination, jointly developing a comprehensive mountain bike system. Town manager Dave Cota says it's paying off.
You go to the parking lots at the trailheads. They're filled up even in the summer, and we never saw that. A lot of it's second homeowners. I think they've got, you know, they've really got a reason to come back here. In fact, what we're starting to hear is that people are actually buying property here because of the mountain bike trail development.
One telling sign, restaurants that once closed down when the forest leafed out are now staying open year-round. For Here and Now, I'm Fred Bever.
People, check out your local family-owned ski places. Fred's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy Hobson is back tomorrow. This is Here and Now.